Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So in the latest in medical news, there has been a major reversal on cholesterol consumption in the U.S. And Marjorie, so to celebrate, you know what I did this morning? I had a 12-egg cheese omelet
for breakfast.
Joining us on the line to talk about these and other medical issues is medical ethicist Art Kaplan, Art's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey, Art.
How are you? I suspect the chickens everywhere are celebrating.
Well, Art Kaplan, I mean, this is a little – this does sort of undermine one's confidence in the United States government's pronouncements on these things. Because for 40 years, we've been hearing cholesterol is bad, cholesterol is bad, cholesterol is bad. And now it's not so bad. So what are we to make of this?
Well, two things. One, science is hard. Two, science is fallible. So – I think in this case, guideline was well-intentioned. You know, they were worried about cholesterol in the bloodstream. They thought if you controlled intake, you might be able to lower it. Makes some sense. Turns out probably not. There's more metabolism and biology in terms of how you process it going on than there is probably how much you're eating. I would say if you're diabetic or have some other health problems, I'd still watch the cholesterol. But they just didn't understand fully the mechanism, and that's just the way, if you will, science is. Sometimes you learn, you know, we've had this fight about salt. That's been a battle for a long time, whether dietary salt is you know, something you should avoid, or is it just some people respond to salt badly. So this is another one of those. Sorry, but there you go.
Okay, so on a practical level, if you happen to be, say, a thin person who tends not to gain weight, but you thought it was a bad idea to drink whole milk and eat whole yogurt and butter, even though you don't gain weight, but because of the cholesterol thing and you don't have high cholesterol, should you just go ahead and go back to the whole milk and the butter and say, as long as my cholesterol doesn't go up and I don't gain weight, this is great?
So, Marjorie, you know I'm a philosopher.
Yeah.
And I am... maybe the last employed philosopher in the world, but yes, I am one. And my favorite doctor is not an MD. My favorite doctor is Aristotle. And what Aristotle said, though, these many years ago was moderation in all things, excess in none. That's what I think.
Yes. Okay. So it's okay in moderation. That's wonderful news.
But, you know, Marjorie, hey, Art Kaplan, Marjorie broached the issue of how do we have confidence in the public health system or whatever. And while she did say this has been the policy for 40 years, as recently as 5 years ago, the same entity that now says it's not a big problem said it was a problem. So it's even a recent affirmation. But my concern is less the non-confidence issue and more how you communicate a message. Moderation is a nice message. We wouldn't be the second fattest nation on earth if people bought the moderation notion. We used to be number one, but Mexico or Qatar or somebody has passed this. My concern is how do you explain to the public? The article I read about this, an Associated Press story, says the new view does not reverse warnings about high levels of so-called bad cholesterol in the blood, which has been linked to heart disease. So to use a word that John Kerry uses a lot, it's a nuanced message. It's not that we're saying forget all those concerns we voiced. There's still some concerns, but they're not quite what they used to be. How do you convey that to a busy public?
Well, basically, you want to get your blood tested, see if you're in that bad cholesterol group and a big outlier, that probably is something that's going to get addressed by medicines, not by diet. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're way, way overweight, you're probably going to have to do something about that to drive down cholesterol anyway. So the busy public, what I would say is make sure you wear your seatbelt, get a lot of sleep. If you jog around a little bit, move around, that's good. And, you know, your doctor will handle the cholesterol issue for you. Don't listen to fanatics about watch this, watch that. If you maintain good health habits, you're probably doing about as much risk reduction as you're going to get done.
Okay, but one more thing, like on the practical level. This seems to mean that things like margarine, which tend to have a lot more chemicals in them and used to have trans fats in a lot of them until we found out that was terrible and took those out, you know, they're not as natural. I mean, I've always been more of a you're better off with the fewest number of ingredients, you know, and not have a lot of chemicals in your food. So it seems like
You want chemicals in our food, but I know what you mean. Artificial.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That you would be better off with real butter, not margarine, and that you'd be better off with real eggs and not egg whites, as long as you don't have, maybe it's a genetic predisposition to cholesterol or a weight problem.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there is some notion. On the other hand, butter is artificially constructed, too. It just happens to be something that was made, a long time ago, but it's not like it exists in nature. Ice cream, same
right.
category. These are all things that we whipped up to enjoy ourselves. Same thing as cotton candy and so forth. So, again, I'm going to come back to the do it moderately kind
okay.
of advice.
Okay.
I think that's your best policy. I don't think you have to ban entire swaths of food. I've been watching the paleo diet a little bit.
And
I think that's interesting because, cavemen may have eaten certain things and hunted them and killed things with their bare hands and whatever other things they were doing in caveman days, I'll bet they had a lot of food poisoning and they didn't really know how to cook their food. So it's sort of like it doesn't necessarily mean it's good for you just because it's natural.
Yeah. And you have a lot of confusion among mothers, too, because, the idea was you weren't supposed to give your kid whole milk after a certain point mm-hmm. in childhood. I mean, this may be all different as well. I don't know, because whole milk does make you feel more full than
Yes, that's true. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's been some evidence that if you drink whole milk, you just drink less because
exactly.
you fill up. No, that's right. So, look, diet is a weird world within medicine and science. We don't really fully understand it. I'm going to confess medicine does better at treating diseases than it does at figuring out what's the best sort of life routine for people, what's the healthiest way to go. Starting to do that, that's good. And we're also starting to understand what our ancestors gave us in terms of genes,
right.
which make us different. So more advice, individualized, coming soon. Right now, take the moderate course.
One last thing on this. While I was mocking your moderation advice a minute ago, the few minutes in my life, and there haven't been many, when I've actually practiced moderation, including if I'm dying to have something, have one bite of it as opposed to, four pieces of it, has worked incredibly well. I'm serious, but it is amazing how difficult it is to get to such a sensible place in terms of everything, exercise, diet, whatever. So,
hey, you're talking to the sinner who says, I think I'll just have one spoonful of that ice cream out of the fridge there. Just one. Oh, where's
Jim,
that pint?
Okay.
Gone?
Aren't you going to ask about your religious devotion to oatmeal?
No, I'm not, because I don't want to hear that I'm wrong about it. Steel-cut oats have changed my life, so I don't want to hear if Art Kaplan doesn't like them. They are good, right?
I don't like them.
Okay, well, fine. Hey, Art, obviously the story of the last few days, the story of the last week or so has been Brian Williams, obviously now on a six-month leave, which most of us think means he's never getting his job back. There is a small minority of people who are saying this may not be the lying that the American public seems to think it is, but this may be a classic case of what I guess people call false memory. And the evidence they use of that beyond the science is in the early days, right after it happened on NBC News, he told the truth. In a blog that he wrote in 2008, he told the truth. And then all of a sudden, David Letterman and Madison Square Garden, and he did a different story. Are you buying this notion? Is it conceivable that, first of all, what is false memory? And secondly, is it conceivable that's what he suffers from?
Well, false memory is a real phenomena. It's certainly been studied in psychology. We know a lot about it because of evaluations of courtroom testimony where people remember things that didn't happen, remember seeing people that couldn't have been there, misdescribe situations. We also know that false memory is partly caught up in emotions, tension, fear. Someone's mugging somebody, you're trying to watch what's happening, you're all excited, you're scared. Some of that seems to influence the construction of false memories. Distractions can give you a false memory. Those are those famous studies some of the listeners will know. You watch people dancing and a gorilla moves through the scene. And then you ask people after they watch a tape, was there a gorilla in there? And they say, no, what are you, crazy? But they were just watching the dancers, so to speak. They didn't see this thing go through. So we do know something about it. Do I think Brian Williams is afflicted with this? Absolutely not.
Why?
I mean, it's for a couple of reasons. First, he's got a pattern. He's upgraded memories. Second, the upgrades are all favorable to him. That is to say, he's not falsely remembering.
That's a good point.
That he didn't do anything when the helicopter caught on fire or
yeah.
he jumped under his seat or something. It's everything has been sort of, this favors me, this favors me. I'm looking heroic or I'm looking like I faced danger and came through it. It's too focused on him. The false memories aren't about, you know, other things. They're always about where Brian Williams was and stuff. I think there is no doubt that he is cooked. He can't come back. All he's got as a person who reads the news is trust. And he corroded it because he's got a pattern over time of distorting the truth about him in a positive way. That's not false memory.
You know, Art Kaplan, I know you're not a psychiatrist, but do you have any insight on this is really, I think, to the average person, bizarre. I mean, he's a superstar making millions and millions of dollars a year. Everybody loves to have him on their show and stuff. Why do people do this? It's like a death wish, it seems to me.
I think there's some thrill in gambling and taking risk. We know it when people drive too fast. We know it when they go to casinos. There's some part of us that likes to sort of gamble, let's put it that way, and manage the gambling and beat the odds. And I think there's a version of that for some of us about how we embellish the truth or where we go in terms of, you know, taking a big risk in public. I think that's some of it. The other is, I think it's just insecurity. Just because you're doing well doesn't mean you're not an insecure person. So you constantly feel like I got to beat my rivals or I have to reconfirm my credibility to make sure people will listen to me. So you can be pretty insecure and do pretty well.
Okay. It just seems so crazy to me. I mean, there's a sadness here because the guy is like, you say, he is cooked. I mean, he's been suspended without pay for 6 months.
I can't believe people argue about that. It's sort of like, he's never coming back.
No, he's clearly never coming back.
What are they going to say? You know, he's going to confront a politician about lying, or he's going to put ads on against his rivals on the networks and say, you know, watch Brian Williams. He didn't tell the truth for a while, but he's getting better.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I have to say, you know, you talk about competition and insecurity. Marjorie knows this. I haven't mentioned this in the air. I would never even think about talking about having won the silver medal in the decathlon in Montreal right behind Bruce Jenner because I don't need to. I want to be judged on the work I do, not what I've done in the past. So that's just.
I understand that. Hey, by the way, you reminded me of something else.
What's
people
that?
In the combat situation, you know, it's not cool to talk about that. In fact, they don't. Mm-hmm. So vets and others who've been through, you know, tough things and so forth, you really have to drag it out of them. And part of the reason I'm really skeptical here that this isn't false memory or misremembering or something is it came out too easy. You know, it wasn't like drag it out of me. It was just like, you just did it. It was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to buy some milk. And by the way, did you know I was shot down? And, you know, it's sort of like.
You know, on that note, two stories you may not be familiar with. Let me just tell them really briefly. A very close friend of mine I knew for 10 years before I knew that, one, he had been in Vietnam, and two, until I saw him in a picture with John Kerry in the New York Times Sunday magazine, I did not know that he was the co-founder of Vietnam Veterans Against the War for 15 years. And most recently here, I don't know if you know him, Seth Moulton, new congressperson. We talked about this a lot.
Walter, I know of him.
Walter Robinson did this great thing in the Boston Globe in the middle of a campaign in which he had never mentioned running for Congress against an incumbent that he had been decorated. That was fairly amazing for a politician. What was 10 times more amazing, he had never even told his parents that he had been decorated and won medals for his service, which I think underlines the point that you made beautifully.
Before we leave this, Art Kaplan, one last thing. We talked a lot about this in Boston in the context of the pre-sex abuse scandal, where so many young victims, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, claimed that they had totally forgotten about this, that they'd wiped it clean from their memory until something jolted it out of their memory when they were 20 or 30 or 40. What is the science on that now?
So there, I think you've got situations where something horrible happens and people try to repress it.
Yep.
Rape, torture, molestation, that sort of thing. We do know that people do try to just repress that stuff and don't want to think about it and don't want to address it. So that much I understand. It goes back to that, what I was saying about, you know, stress and fear and all those sort of things making you see things in a different way, or you slap an interpretation on it that's sort of like, oh, well, you know, nothing much happened. I'm thinking here, remember, Marjorie, the Joe Paterno thing, the guy saw the other guy in the shower, the guy who saw it said, well, they were just horsing around, I thought.
Yeah.
I think he probably saw more than that, but I don't think he wanted to believe it. So he saw it in a different way. And I get all that. But again, that's not the pattern that you got with Brian Williams.
It's
too much bragging.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist from NYU. Art, I was reading the Washington Post the other day, and I read this line: "But a doctor is not just another person with First Amendment rights to free speech." The author of the op-ed was suggesting, I think seriously, and that's my question, that a headline is "Revoke the licenses of any doctor who opposes vaccination." The author of that terrific op-ed was you, by the way. I'm sure you know that. I don't know if listeners do.
I don't really remember that.
Did you mean that? Were you trying to make a point, or you really meant the point that if there are deniers in the medical profession about the importance of mandatory vaccination, that they shouldn't have their licenses?
Well, so my argument was, if I go to you and you tell me that vaccines are unsafe or they don't do any good, and I'm trying to decide whether to vaccinate my kid, then you've just violated my informed consent. You didn't give me the right information that I would need. You could say, I'm a little worried about vaccines, or, you know, I've heard that people sometimes want to go off the schedule or whatever. But if you tell me they hurt you more than they help you, or you tell me it's better to get the diseases, which a few crazy doctors have said, then I think you got a case. And there I think they are breaking their license. And, yeah, I would go after them.
Good.
Because they violate my right to know the truth. How am I going to decide about vaccinating my kid if I got some nutball telling me that, you know, better to get measles and mumps, you know, go to a measles party and give each other the measles?
Could anybody ever really lose their license? And let's assume that that someone did what you hope they don't do. Can you imagine a circumstance in which their license would actually be revoked for that kind of advice?
I could, because you could get somebody who really got harmed. So somebody might have a kid, and then they infect another newborn baby in the house, and they hadn't vaccinated the first kid, and the baby dies or goes blind or deaf because of mumps or something. Yeah, I can imagine that. I could. Again, you know, part of the problem is, how good are we at medical discipline and monitoring licenses? Pretty bad. I mean, those boards, we can go, there's a whole show there about why aren't they tougher for doctors who, you know, do all sorts of crazy and bad things. A small number, but they're out there, but they don't get their licenses. That system's weak.
Be interesting to see where this plays in the Republican primaries with Senator Rand Paul, an ophthalmologist who's one of the vaccination deniers.
He's not a total denier, by the way. He's allegedly for parental choice and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, saying it's not that big of a deal, I think, is a problem for him. Let's move on to this whole thing about the airbags for ski racers. Obviously, ski racers, these guys catapulting down the slopes at 70, 80, 90 degrees. They get a lot of terrible injuries, punctured lungs, internal bleeding, according to this piece in the New York Times. So there's this proposal for airbags for ski racers, but the racers are not that enthusiastic about embracing them, despite the injuries.
Yeah, and so my attitude is, and we care why? I mean, these are like ski racers. It's like asking test pilots, do you think we should put some safety features in, you know, your airplanes? Or, I don't know, teenagers, do you think it would be good to wear a helmet when you're on a skateboard or so? I mean, the people who do it, this goes back to something we were talking about earlier. They love the risk. They love to take risks. They're enculturated that you're a weenie if you are afraid of a big crash. I mean, who the heck is going off a ski jump or going down a mountain at a million miles a second who's risk avoiding? So the sports regulators and the authorities have to step in and say, okay, going to have to wear goggles, going to have to wear a helmet, going to have to put a little whatever that – I don't really understand how that thing works, but a blow-up bag if you crash. You know, people who love risk aren't going to sit down and say, I want safety features designed first and foremost for me. Outsiders have to do it. Third parties have to do it. I can't even believe this is an argument. If they've got something that can protect people, why wouldn't they make them wear it?
Okay, Art, it is perfect that you responded as you did. For years and years and years, as recently as yesterday, Marjorie has taken valuable airtime to mock me when I say, based upon the $4 billion of cost for injuries from sledding, most of which applies to the 160 or 140,000 kids who were in sledding incidents, that minors should be required, not advised, required to wear helmets when they're sledding, which is what everybody in Greater Boston is doing, obviously, for the last few weeks. Where are you on this?
Are you sure? Why not? I mean, what's the big intrusion?
Go ahead, Marjorie. What's the big intrusion?
Because,
talking to Art Kaplan.
Because I just don't like the government mandating this and the government mandating that. If you want to wear a helmet, you want to put your kids in helmets. I mean, why not have helmets in cars, Art? That's
why not have car seats in cars?
Well, we do have car seats.
Exactly. I mean, that's his point.
But it's not voluntary. It's like you got to do it.
Exactly. But if you're talking about mandating things, there's a lot more children injured in car accidents than there are on sleds. So why not have them in cars?
I mean, I sled the mighty hills of Framingham for years. I helmetless and, I don't know, half demented or whatever I was, frostbitten and hypothermic. But, you know, we put helmets on kids who ride bikes.
Yep.
Why don't we put helmets on kids who sled? It's like, what big liberty is lost here? I don't see the intrusion. And if I wait for parents to do the right thing with their kids, I'm going to be waiting a long time on that one.
Art, you are
okay.
Exactly,
but you evaded,
perfect
you
on
did,
this issue.
You did, and Jim does this too.
What's
and
that?
So, Art, you kind of slipped around.
What's that?
The why not mandate them in cars?
Oh, you mean put helmets on kids in cars?
Yes.
Yeah.
If the evidence got in there, car racers do it. I guess I could imagine the case. I just haven't seen information that says if you seatbelt them and airbag them, and for little kids car seat them, that a helmet would be needed. But you know, there are times when I see people in crashes smashed all over the highway, and I'm thinking, boy, a car racer wouldn't go in his car without a helmet. Why would you?
Okay, when this happens, when the government mandates all helmets on kids, we're going to blame Art Kaplan and Jim Browdy.
Well, that's your point of view. My view is I loved Art before today. I love him even more now. Now, Art Kaplan.
Now, let me tell you, yeah. I think those helmets should be lined with tinfoil to protect us against radiation being beamed in from aliens far away.
Well, that goes without saying, of course. So what's on the Everyday Ethics Podcast this week, Art Kaplan?
Oh, Brian Williams. That show gets to get outside of science and health, so we'll come back to that. Although, as you guys know, I don't see this as a huge dispute. I know people want to have the argument. I know I've seen people say, let's apologize our way out of this. Put all that aside. You guys are in the news business. You do all kinds of news things. Can either of you really imagine him coming back after six months, no matter what happened?
No.
I think they should do a switch. People have been talking about John Stewart going to Brian Williams. I think Brian Williams should go to the fake news. He's very talented, did very well on Saturday Night Live. Maybe he could join the comedy world and do
very
well.
I'm going to tell you something funny. I've seen those suggestions all over the internet. Mm-hmm. I don't think he can even handle the credibility problem on the fake news. The fake news relies on some credibility.
Whoa.
Oh, gosh.
Art Kaplan, it's a pleasure as always. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you, Art Kaplan. Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast.